Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talked to Dr. Ray Tomalty. He's Principal of Smart Cities Research Services and an adjunct professor in the School of Urban Planning at McGill University. In other words, he's an expert on urban planning and development. Indeed, these issues will be front of mind as the municipal election rolls on into September, so I wanted to dedicate some time in the podcast over the next couple of months to talk about how development happens in the city. And we're going to start with the big picture. Why development happens the way it does, academically speaking, is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. This journey began when I saw someone on Facebook use the term Guelphist saga as a way of describing development in the South End. I believe it was meant to be an insult, a way of saying that the rapid build of mid-rises and high-rises in Mississauga is ugly and will be deleterious to the character and charm of the city of Guelph as they're being constructed in the South End here. Always the contrarian, I was looking for a counter-argument, and that's when I came upon Ray Tomalty. A 2016 Metroland article quoted Tomalty about the changes in Mississauga. He said, quote, "Mississauga is the microcosm of the change in planning culture taking place across the country, slowly, one city at a time." That's a peculiar notion, since many in Ontario see Mississauga as an example of how not to develop. In fact, a 1974 Globe and Mail article called Mississauga an aggressively bland community of two-car garages, hamburger stands, windy plazas, tacky acres of new townhouses, and bulky apartments. That was a quote. And that's the way Mississauga has been seen the last 44 years. Are we wrong, though? Tomalty told Metroland that the Mississauga of today is, quote, "one of the greatest examples of how suburbs in Canada are trying to turn themselves from low-density sprawl and urban form to something more interesting, more urbane, more structured, more vital, and more lively," unquote. It's likely that Tomalty will have a tough time convincing the ones talking about Guelph's saga that such a transformation has its benefits, but if the experts are saying that Mississauga has learned the lessons of its own transformation in the 70s and 80s, then maybe there's something for us to learn from it. For context, I talked to Dr. Tomalty shortly after Guelph City Council approved the second phase of the Claire Maltby Plan, so it was top of mind. Dr. Tomalty lent his expertise to the discussion and talked about the challenges and opportunities of planning over 500 hectares of undeveloped land, and he offers some reasons to suggest that the city of Guelph may be thinking about density backwards, at least when it comes to Claire Maltby. So on this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast, we talk about that, and we also talk about the difficulty of incorporating affordable housing into development plans, and the differing definitions of affordability, plus strategies on how cities and developers can combat NIMBYism, and what exactly it takes to be a smart city. This is a very tight 20-minute conversation. So I caught up with Dr. Tomalty a few weeks ago from his office in Montreal. So I want to start with... because we have an area in Guelph that is currently being considered for planning. It is a large section of space that is, for the most part, undeveloped right now. It's 520 hectares. Right. And I'm wondering, in your experience or in your knowledge, how often does something like this occur where in a Canadian city where there's this big plot of land that has sat undeveloped that the city gets to basically plan from scratch?
You know, that's a very big parcel of land. If it's at the city edge, then that is problematic because, you know, the progressive movements in planning are to try to limit the extension of the urban fabric at the edge and to concentrate development in the already built-up area. Mm-hmm. So, are you familiar with the term smart growth? Is that something that rings for you? Or?
It rings for me, but maybe for the listeners, you can describe it a bit.
Right. Okay. Well, smart growth is basically the idea that we've spread enough in terms of our urban fabric after the Second World War with the under the influence of the automobile as the primary mode of transportation,
right.
We spread out into very thin fabric. And For decades, we thought that that was going to be a really highly successful way of providing cheap housing on a very large scale, industrial scale, to the the working and middle classes, and it was successful for many decades until the crows started coming home to roost, and we realized that there were all kinds of system level dysfunctionalities associated with that that nobody had anticipated at the beginning. So it worked on an individual level, but on the system level, it started faltering and produced a lot of congestion and air pollution, and consumed farmland and ecological resources, and led to social isolation, and especially for women, and and for kids who can't drive. So it started showing its weaknesses in the 80s and after that, and since then there's been a movement called Smart Growth, started in the 1990s in the United States, which is a is basically a movement amongst planners, architects, some progressive developers, and city leaders, city builders, to try to rein in the spread of the urban fabric and to concentrate development energy into the already built up area. So in a nutshell, building up instead of out, and adding density to neighborhoods, and especially around good quality transit stops and corridors. To encourage people to use their cars less, or to to own fewer cars or no cars, and to walk, bike, and take transit more, which is a far more sustainable form of mobility.
Right.
And to improve access through density and mix of land uses. So instead of concentrating on moving from one place to the next in order to get to your destination, putting the destinations together so you don't have to move.
Right.
And through density and mix of uses. In other words, having various daily destinations within walking or biking or easy transit distance.
What's interesting is what you just said is a lot of what's been said by the city planning department and the city officials, that they're going to take this 520 hectares and they're going to have that mixed use. They're going to have the high density with the low density, plus a concentration of transit and mixed use and commercial and all of that. But what you kind of said at the top there was the trend is more to concentrating in the core where the city's already built. So it almost seems like we're at cross purposes with what the city has in mind for this area of land.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the best way to approach urban growth when there's a demand for more housing and other land uses is to really exhaust the opportunities for growth within the already urbanized area and to identify those parcels that can accommodate growth, either empty parcels or parcels that are at low density that can be redeveloped at higher density, especially around transit routes and stations. And once all of those opportunities have been explored, then you need to develop at the fringe again. So it's a fringe if necessary, but not necessarily fringe, right? So you look at it's not just the core; it's the whole urbanized area. The core is a prime example of where you could densify, but it's not just the core. So yes, it depends. I don't know. I'm not that familiar with the planning situation in Guelph, so I don't know whether all of the other parcels that could accommodate growth have already been explored within the urban envelope.
Yeah,
and now it's necessary to. I know that Guelph is a growing community, so it's quite possible that this is justified and that the city is doing the best possible. Choosing the best possible path it can under the circumstances.
Right. I think you know, I myself covering municipal politics can't necessarily get into the heads of the planners, but I think that Guelph, as you indicated, is kind of under the gun to grow, and that because of places to grow out here in Ontario, it's not just a matter of intensifying the core, but you know, also kind of building the fringes at the same time, where wherever there's an open parcel of land, it seems that we have to be building on it at once, because there's, you know, 20,000, 25,000 people waiting to come here in the next 12 to 15 years.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, too, about where affordable housing comes into this, because, you know, you and your group have talked a lot about it. But one of the things I've encountered is that there's kind of no clear definition of affordable housing. And, you know, I think when a lot of people hear affordable housing, they think social housing, you know, housing geared to income. But I know that the city of Guelph's definition is basically a little cheaper than market price. Is that a problem in talking about the need for affordable housing, is that we kind of don't have a clear definition of it?
Yeah, it is a problem, because we're often talking past each other because we're not sure what we're talking about. So yes, there's a spectrum of affordability that goes all the way from, you know, homeless shelters for people in precarious housing situations with no, you know, no fixed address, and through to social housing, you know, subsidized by the state, and then rental, you know, vouchers, and then below market ownership housing. So there's a full range of housing, affordable housing types. But the definition that is most widely accepted is, if you're spending more than 30% of your income on housing, then your housing is not affordable. So that's the most accepted definition of whether your home is affordable or not.
And I'm wondering too, speaking academically, what role do developers play in this? Because to use Guelph as an example, because that's the example I know, but, you know, we have incentives here for developers to build more affordable housing. It just seems that, you know, a lot of it is, of course, being market driven. And I think that's the concern, is that, you know, you can get a tract of land and build a single detached home and sell it for, you know, $400,000, $500,000.
Yeah.
And because it's market driven, there's you can have all the incentives you want, but the incentive for the developers is always going to be more money. So how do developers become a part of that process?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it that it's developers that are driving the spread model, and they always have, because that's the highest, that's the easiest for them. It involves the least number of barriers, because if you're building at the fringe, then you don't have neighbors to deal with. So you don't have NIMBY, right? There's nobody around to complain. And hardly anybody's going to complain about a single family detached home anyway, because that's the sort of, you know, the Canadian moral standard for housing.
Right.
It's all the other types of housing that attract NIMBY type resistance, like anything other than single detached. So, so developers have a real interest in, and you can also, you know, do tract housing that's on an industrial scale, and it's very easy to organize, and land is very cheap. So for all those reasons, yes, developers are, they really do push the sprawl model, and that's where the big profits are, because if they can get a piece of land that's zoned it for agriculture and then convert it into land zoned for residential or mixed-use development, that's where the windfall profits are, is that in that that rezoning is where the money is. When you're developing in the city, you might need a rezoning, but it's going to be rezoning from one form of to another form of urban use, so the profits are not as impressive. It's the profits are going from, are found when you move from agricultural to urban use. That's where the big jump is. And then, you know, the city brings in the infrastructure, so that increases the to support growth, the infrastructure needed to support growth, like the water and sewage. So that also leads to big bounce in the land value.
Right.
So that's why the developers are really interested in the sprawl model, because that it's the growing edge of the city that has the highest profit gradient.
Right.
And inside the city, the profits are lower. Even if the densities are higher, you'd think that, you know, rationally, that if you can put more units on a given piece of land, that your profits are going to be bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But there is that, but it's the really big time profits are at the fringe, or developing single family homes at the fringe. That's where you get it. So yes,
right.
they're driving that, and of course the developers are the ones who are funding most of the municipal councillors in terms of their election finances.
Right.
So they have an in with the. It's something like 90% of successful local candidates for local council are funded through the development industry.
Mm.
So you have a conveyor belt connecting the developers to the councillors, and many of the councillors are drawn from the development industry. They're either real estate agents or, you know, landscape architects or landscapers, or they're builders or developers, or they do business with builders and developers. They have something to do with land development, many
right.
of them. So it's all part of the worldview that you should be expanding at the fringe.
Right.
And it's just very, very difficult. It's called the growth machine. I don't know if you're familiar with that
term. I haven't heard that term, no.
Yeah, it comes from the 1980s. Some academics in the United States invented that and talked about how developers form, you know, coalitions with counselors and other growth-oriented professionals and businesses in order to produce growth of a certain type, which is highly profitable and not necessarily, you know, yeah. We always have to, if we're interested in sustainability, we have to balance profit with people and planet. Those are the three P's. So that model really is a not balanced model. It's much more tilted towards the profit end of things and not so much the people and planet
right.
Part of it.
Well, so, I think speaking to the people part of it, and you mentioned NIMBYism, which I think is sort of the other factor in this, where just when you hear people speaking to city council, they're never against development. They're always like, I am in favor of development, just not this development, or just not this development in this
right.
place. So what is the antidote to NIMBYism? Because I feel like this is a fight that is going to happen in any area of any city where there is already development, where when you were talking
yeah.
about intensification, there's always going mm-hmm. to be a neighborhood group that is against
yes.
the intensification. So
there always will be.
Yeah.
Always will be. You have to, that is part of the redevelopment game. When you're working in the already urbanized area, you call it redevelopment as opposed to development
right.
or new development. So that's part of the redevelopment game. Is NIMBYism is just that's just something you have to deal with. And you know, it's not necessarily a negative thing, because what we call not in my backyard syndrome just basically is people trying to protect their quality of life.
Right.
So you have to listen to them, and there are ways of handling that in a constructive, more of a win-win rather than win-lose type attitude. So you can involve, you know, there have been studies done showing when people are involved in the design of the new project, that changes can be made that don't affect the profitability that much, that that can massively improve the quality of the project from the point of view of the neighbors. You know, things to do with the shape or the casting of shadows, or you know, that sort of thing, or the exterior cladding or the landscaping, or, you know, which direction the balconies face, you know, that type of thing can make a big difference to the people in the immediate environment of the development,
right.
and not that much of a difference to the developer in terms of profitability. So, so those things are win-win. The other thing that you can do is basically tit for tat, namely, okay, so you see this as this new building as a negative, but let's throw in some positives. So you get the developer to fund some amenities, right? Like a new daycare, a new community center, some public art, some affordable housing, street furniture, benches, and upgrades to the streetscape, new sidewalks, awnings, trees. There are lots of things that developers can do in order to improve the environment around a building in the zone where people feel that they're being affected by the new development. So
I wonder if it would help if, because I feel the way the process goes is the developer brings something to City Hall, and then City Hall takes it to the City Council meeting for approval, and then the neighbors find out about it because, of course, they're given notification that this is a planning matter coming to City Council, and they're kind of got caught by surprise. So I wonder if the first move should be to go to the neighborhood first and knock on all the doors and say, this is what we're planning to do here. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, that what you're talking about, what you're putting your finger on, should be actually the cornerstone of the local planning system for site development.
Mm-hmm.
The process should start with involving the local community, get their initial reaction, and hear about possible concerns. There are some concerns that are just not worth listening to, right? Like when people say we don't want other types of people in our neighborhood.
Sure.
You know what that is code for, like
right.
It's code for classism or racism or some kind of ism that people are just being xenophobic and not willing to share the urban environment with other people, all of whom have a right to the city, right?
Right.
You can't just say that the city is for use by a certain type of person and other people should live in another country or something like that.
Right, of course.
That's just not acceptable.
Yeah.
But people, it's not all that, right? There are lots of legitimate concerns that come up. So yes, there should be pre-consultation with local groups, local stakeholders and individuals. And one, there is a provision in Ontario called complete application requirements that the provincial government enabled about 10 years ago through changes to the Planning Act. And it allows municipal governments to require that developers do some extensive pre-planning and submit a full roster of studies and plans as part of their application, rather than just putting in a little application saying we're going to put up a 25-story building here. They have to submit that with a whole list of studies on shadowing and wind and traffic and parking and heat effects and energy use and design guidelines and cladding and shape of building and identify all of the secondary impacts of that the building might have on housing prices, et cetera. So, and these are available for the public to review. So there's already provision in the Planning Act for this. Now, I'm not sure whether Guelph has adopted one of these complete application requirement bylaws, because it's an enabling law at the provincial level, and
right.
The municipality has to enable it by adopting a local bylaw that puts it into place. So that would be something to look into, to see whether Guelph is signed on to this, because it does empower citizens and citizen groups to interact on a more equal footing with developers.
And once again, that was Dr. Ray Tomalty, and you can learn more about the work of Smart City Research Services at smartcities.ca, and you can find Dr. Tomalty's latest book, America's Urban Future, which he co-wrote with Alan Malak, at islandpress.org. And that's it for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics. It's Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can also go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.